This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
With climate, there is shocking news and super shocking news. We just learned that many more humans could be flooded out by rising seas, hundreds of millions more people possibly than we thought. Published October 29, 2019, the new study is titled New Elevation Data Triple Estimates of Global Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Coastal Flooding. The authors are Scott Culp and Benjamin Strauss, both from the nonprofit news source Climate Central. Our guest, Dr. Benjamin Strauss, is CEO and Chief Scientist for Climate Central. From Princeton, New Jersey, Ben, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks so much for having me.
As a scientist, you study sea level rise, and your bio credits you as, quote, the architect of the surging seas suite of maps, tools, and visualizations. How does that tie in with the paper just released in Nature Communications?
Well, really, it's just a continuation of the ongoing work we've been doing for the last 10 years or so. In this case, we're extending work that has mostly been focused on the United States to global coverage.
And your new paper talks about extreme coastal water level. What do you mean by that?
We mean water levels that are beyond your day-to-day usual. So we do assess land below projected high tide lines in the future as sea levels continue to rise. But we assess land below the projected annual flood level, which is one flavor of an extreme coastal water level. Extreme coastal water level is a little bit scientist speak, but the annual flood level is one that you expect to be exceeded once a year on average. So some years it might not happen at all, but other years it might happen twice. Over the course of 10 years, you'd expect it to happen 10 times. So basically, you don't want to live on land lower than that or get flooded that often unless you build coastal defenses or have some other way to accommodate. Obviously, it wouldn't be acceptable to have salt water in your living room once a year on average.
Right, that's very damaging. Now, the shocking thing to me was that we didn't know, really, the elevation of the Earth in so many key places along the coasts. Ben, how would you explain the problems with using NASA's Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, or SRTM?
The heart of this research was we looked someplace that the scientific community was not looking. Almost all the effort in sea level science and climate science is to project the future. What will future sea levels be? How will the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica change? And those are really difficult questions, and it's hard to know. But all of our eyes have been on those moving objects, and we realized that you really need to know two things, the height of the water, which is changing, but also the height of the land, in order to understand how many people are at risk. And in 2014, my colleague Scott and I realized that there was a big problem with the global elevation data produced by NASA for using it for this purpose. Basically, we're standing on NASA's shoulders, to be clear. Their data is tremendous and has been a very important global service, but it's just not that well suited to coastal flood risk analysis. And the reason is that it was based on a satellite mission on the Space Shuttle Endeavour flown in February 2000, and they used radar technology to basically estimate the elevation of land, the distance from the satellite. But the footprint of that signal that came down was about 100 feet in diameter, and blended in information from rooftops and treetops as well as the ground. So the average elevation that bounced back to the satellite, in effect, was more than 6 feet too high on average in coastal zones, according to our research. And that's what we've worked to improve.
So how did you get around that to get more accurate pictures of where the land really is?
We took the NASA data. We took more than 20 other variables, and we basically put them into a blender using artificial intelligence to come up with an approach that essentially removes the effect of buildings and trees. And the way that we know that a works is by comparing the results of our approach against places where we actually have very accurate readings of elevation. And it turns out our model works very well when we test it in that way. And even when we test it in places that are far away from the places that we used for building the model in the first place.
So this new digital elevation model reported in your paper, it checks against 23 variables, including things like vegetation and buildings, as you mentioned. And the computer power to do that on a global scale must be incredible. Talk to us about what Scott Culp brings to this project.
Well, Scott Culp has been an incredible collaborator with me for many years now, and he just has a knack for solving thorny big data problems very efficiently. That's what a strong computer scientist or big data expert can do. The idea of what you're trying to accomplish may not be so hard if you look at it at a micro scale, but then when you multiply it against the whole Earth, it's a lot of computation that you have to do. So you have to find very efficient ways. And Scott is really a genius at that. And we are fortunate to have benefited from the development of machine learning and AI technologies. So certainly there are improving packages that were available for us to use to help us. We didn't have to do it all from scratch.
Well, Ben, we all want to know how this story turns out. Let's start with the low emissions scenario. What is the new estimate of how many people currently live below the projected high tide lines for the year 2100 if we manage to keep warming at 2 degrees C?
So I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but a key point here is that we can make a significant difference between a high emission scenario versus a low emission scenario in terms of the exposure of people at the end of the century. There's not a huge difference at the middle of the century because most of the sea level rise between now and mid-century is already in the pipeline. Sea level is still catching up. The glaciers and ice sheets are still catching up to the warming that we have already caught. But there really can be a meaningful difference by the end of the century. And certainly beyond the end of the century, depending on what carbon pathway we follow. And I think one of the big, the other side of the coin for our analysis, which shows that more than three times as many people are at risk as we thought, the other side of the coin is the benefit of cutting climate pollution is far greater than we thought. So the benefit-cost equation may really change here. There's a lot more harm that we can avoid if we can cut emissions.
In your vulnerability numbers, are you talking about territory that just totally disappears under the waters or a once-a-year flood or what?
That's a great question. We present territory that would be either below high tide line, effectively becoming part of the ocean environment, and we also give numbers that show how much land would be below the annual flood level, so occasional flooding, but increasing at increasing frequencies. Something else that's really important to understand is we did not have data on coastal defenses like levees as part of this study. We couldn't find any global data on that. So part of our analysis found that there are 110 million people already living on land below high tide line, according to our analysis. And that tells us two possible things. One, that there are coastal defenses already in place protecting those people. Two, that our data may underestimate elevation, say the elevation is too low in some places, or some combination. It's probably a combination of those things because we do know that a lot of people are already protected by levees in places as far-ranging as the Netherlands or Jakarta, Shanghai, or Guyana in South America. So the fact that so many people are already protected by coastal defenses to some degree does indicate the potential to build on those defenses and build new defenses in the future as well. So it's another kind of little bit of hopefulness, I guess, in our findings. Although, of course, most of the places that are protected by defenses today, I think were probably developed at or below sea level in a way that left space for those defenses, and it may be quite a different matter to protect cities that were developed with the assumption that they would always be above sea level. But I wouldn't say that our analysis says all of these places are going to disappear. Some will, but others will be defended, and in other cases, there are places where we may have put the elevation data too low, some other places where we put it too high. It's certainly not the last word. And one of the things I hope that will come out of our research is to stimulate more governments and corporations to collect better elevation data in our coastal areas, to do it directly so that we don't have to rely on things like artificial intelligence to make our best estimate of what the elevation is, but rather we have a very high quality direct measurement. We will never know the future sea level with certainty, but we can know the elevation of land with certainty. And I think maybe the biggest contribution of our research is to show how wrong we're getting elevation globally, and that this problem can be addressed. And it has a huge effect on our estimate of the risk, much bigger than the effect of the current refinements happening in sea level projections and sea level science. So since it's possible to get this right, let's invest and get it right.
I would add just one minor caveat, and that is that some places, like Jakarta, is sinking mainly because people are draining the groundwater out from underneath it, and New England is somewhat sinking on a very slow scale due to subsidence after the glaciers left. So even the ground level is not exactly stable.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Jakarta has such a big problem. They're moving the capital to, the president announced that they're going to move the capital to a new location on a different island.
I'll believe that when I see it, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see if that really happens. I mean, it's a city of tens of millions of people, so it's pretty stunning.
And they're very attached to Java. I've been there, and it's very difficult to get people to move off the main island. Well, look, the main point of your study, and I think maybe the most shocking part, is that you find unimaginable risk developing in Southeast Asia as the Earth warms and those sea levels go up. Where are the highly populated areas most likely to experience what we might even call ocean floods during this century?
Well, we found really large risks across Southeast Asia and extending into South Asia, India and Bangladesh, and around the East Asia, China. China actually has the largest number by far of people living on land vulnerable to falling below the high tide line or chronic flooding. But the biggest multiples of threat were in South and Southeast Asia. So Thailand, if you assess the population in Thailand on low-lying coastal land using the old NASA data, you get around 1 million for, I think, levels that could be below the level of an annual flood by mid-century. And in our analysis, that goes up to around 12 million, so a more than a tenfold increase. India and Bangladesh go up seven or eightfold. And there are also some pretty big factors in Vietnam and other Southeast Asian countries. Philippines and Indonesia also have a really high risk, high multiples and high total risk.
And people think, well, that's far away, that won't affect me. But I remember a couple of years ago there were floods in Thailand, and it turns out that almost all of our hard drives for computing power comes from a few factories there, and they went under. And I wonder, does your new mapping tool suggest that there are threats to Chinese production zones as well?
Well, you're quite right that so many of these Asian megacities are vital nodes in global supply chains for all kinds of things. So absolutely, in a global economy, flooding problems in Asia are going to affect others around the world, including the U.S. and Canada. It's also the case, look at the Syrian conflict, actually. The roots of the Syrian conflict were in a drought, and that drought had climate change fingerprints on it. And the conflict has produced a stream of migrants and refugees, some of whom have fled to Europe, along with some sub-Saharan Africans also going to Europe. And that has produced incredible political instability, not to mention the suffering in Syria and Africa, but also instability in Europe. I mean, that flow of refugees is like a trickle compared to what we could have in the future because of rising sea levels if we're unable to effectively defend land. If, for example, across the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, most places are undefendable and you have farmers who used to farm rice there, you know, their fields become salty and they go to the cities and then you have social unrest and kind of internal movements of refugees and movements between countries creating political unrest or even regional conflict in the longer run. So those kinds of effects could have direct humanitarian consequences where they take place, but they also can affect global supply chains and they can affect global politics as well and national security. I mean, who wants to see Asia turn into a tinderbox of conflict because of climate change? I think that would be very damaging for the West as well as for Asia.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, getting climate science to you straight from the source. Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Strauss, chief scientist and leader at Climate Central. Well, as we speak, and strangely, millions of people still have the dream of moving towards the coasts. I think about half of Americans live within 100 miles of the coasts. This could even increase the exposure counts that, I guess, were these in your new models, the figures for possible migration?
No, we did not include the fact that the current trend is for population growth in coastal areas, just direct growth and through migration. So in that respect, we could be underestimating the threat. And we actually, where we were able to test it in the United States and Australia, we find that we're underestimating the threat compared to what you would get using more accurate elevation data from LIDAR, laser range finder technology. So no, we're not factoring that. It could be a much bigger threat.
Would your new digital elevation models be able to predict, either forward or backward in time, floods like the ones that hit Venice in 1966 or New Orleans in 2005?
It's a good question. I don't see why not. I think for New Orleans, it would be a challenge because levees are such an important part of the picture there. But I think raising New Orleans does raise an issue that's important to understand here. Even if we can defend most of the Asian megacities with levees, let's say, if engineering and coastal defenses can prevent the kind of relocations that we were just talking about, one question to ask is, how deep a bowl is anyone going to want to live inside? And New Orleans gives a good case study because much of that city is already below sea level. It's protected by levees. And Hurricane Katrina in 2005 shows what can happen when those defenses fail. And the consequences can be quite tragic because the flood comes swiftly. You don't have time to escape. When you're at the bottom of the bowl, the water and the defenses are breached, the water rises very swiftly. And most of the cities around the Asian Rim are in places that could be hit by powerful cyclones. And we've seen some incredibly dangerous cyclones in that part of the world over the last number of years, not to mention the possibility of terrorist or other attacks on coastal defenses.
Or tsunamis.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the tsunami comes over your defense, and then suddenly all that water, it can't escape back out to the ocean once it comes through. So coastal defenses can give you a measure of security and protect you against the milder events, but they can actually create a far more dangerous situation for the more extreme events.
Even in America, you and Scott Culp say, quote, sea level rise this century may induce large-scale migration away from unprotected coastlines, redistributing population density across the country and putting great pressure on inland areas, end quote. That doesn't sound good for high-priced coastal real estate or the big banks who carry those mortgages, does it?
No, it doesn't. Research by others suggests that coastal real estate prices in the United States are already lower than they should be for homes in the very lowest of elevations above the high tide line. Doesn't mean that those values are falling, but it means at the very least that they're not climbing as quickly as they would be if the homes were on higher ground. And I expect we will see an acceleration of that trend over time. Also, anecdotally, there certainly are pockets and neighborhoods along U.S. coasts where homes have essentially lost all of their value and residents are trapped. I've seen the stories of people, it's their biggest piece of equity, their home, and now they're flooding multiple times a year. They can't sell. The only homes that sell in that neighborhood, you know, sell for $20,000 or $30,000. That's it. So people essentially become trapped. And either they have to live with the mold and the floods and the damage, replacing their appliances or somehow moving their kitchen up to their bedroom on the second floor, or else they have to lose their biggest piece of equity unless the government comes in to defend them. And right now, the way the Army Corps works, at least, they do a benefit-cost analysis. So they mainly protect wealthy neighborhoods with high real estate values, so that the benefit-cost equation looks good. And from a local perspective, those are, of course, the greatest sources of tax revenue, so there's also incentives to protect. So, yeah, we definitely have a real problem here in the United States already.
Ben Strauss, you lead an organization called Climate Central. Briefly, what is Climate Central? Who founded it, and what do you do?
Climate Central is a research and news organization dedicated to communicating climate changes, effects, and solutions to American and broader publics and decision makers. We particularly try to make climate tangible and local because while it's a global phenomenon, people experience it locally, and we work to make these big changes very tangible and filled with local meaning for people, to cut across ideology, geography, political viewpoint, because we're all in this boat together.
We may need a boat from the sounds of things.
Yes. Well, indeed. Our planet is one boat in the solar system and the universe. It really is.
Let's talk about how to handle all this new information. What tools does your website offer for the public?
So one tool we offer is our Surging Seas suite of coastal maps, the one we just published, which is at coastal.climatecentral.org. We also offer something called Risk Finder at riskfinder.org, which provides extensive analysis by zip code, by city, by county of coastal places around the U.S. And if you come to our main website, climatecentral.org, and click on the media library link, we have an extensive library of thousands of graphics illustrating in simple, powerful TV suitable ways, or teaching suitable ways, or PowerPoint suitable ways, illustrating climate science and climate impacts and climate solutions, both at national and global levels, but principally at local levels in the United States. So you can find graphics that document, for example, trends in warming or precipitation or the prevalence of pollen or poison ivy by individual media market throughout the country.
Some scientific publications require authors to write a plain language summary along with the technical abstract, and frankly, I wish you had done that with this important paper. It's a bit technical to go through. But even so, your new study got a lot of traction in mainstream media, the New York Times to the BBC. So this bad news is shocking, but I wonder, will it really drive up international demand for action? I mean, what does this new paper do for us? Where does it go?
Well, first, I would invite you and your listeners to come to our website. And if you go to that coastal site, you can download more of a layperson's report that we also wrote to complement the paper and explain things a bit more accessibly. We've been tracking, and this has been covered by more than 2,000 media outlets so far in 100 countries. It was cited by the Secretary General of the UN. And we've had more than 500 requests for our new elevation data from around the world, largely the research community. So from the response that we're seeing, yes, there's been a lot of attention, and we're optimistic that now many different research groups will be able to use our data to deepen understanding of our coastal threat through, you know, many more approaches and research lines than we could possibly engage in on our own.
When we get shocking news, it can be a little bit emotional, too. And my first emotions, first of all, I was a little bit angry. I thought, well, why weren't we told there was this big problem and underestimate sooner? But the second was more mature. It was sadness, thinking about the hard times to come that our ancestors might not have been able to imagine. How do you handle the big, ugly picture, Ben? And tell us the truth, is big sea level rise now inevitable?
Well, I think a certain amount of depression or pessimism or just difficult feelings are an occupational hazard if you're a climate scientist. My personal philosophy is that it's never too late to do better. And I try and, for me, the meaning is in trying to do something. I don't see any alternative in looking at this big problem besides asking what's the most that I can do as an individual. And the most I can ask of myself is to do what I can in the direction of trying to confront this great challenge.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to tell our radio and podcast listeners?
Well, I think you've given a really thorough interview. I think if we, to the degree that we lick this problem, to the degree that we solve it, I do think it could be counted as the greatest achievement in all of human civilization. I don't think we necessarily expect that we will be able to head off a pretty catastrophic change. It's looking pretty poor in a lot of ways, but it is never too late to do better, to reduce the chance of some of the really frightening consequences that we could see. And if somehow we can pull it together. I think of climate change as really the easiest hard problem. We're never going to solve, I believe, we're never going to solve human conflict or disease or poverty or justice, right? These are deep human struggles that will continue for all of human history. But climate change is different. We actually know how to solve it. We have the technology that we need. It's the easiest of all the problems, as big as it may seem. What makes it extra hard is the time limit, is the fact that we really need to act now and in the next 10 years, the next 20 years. If you think of our descendants far in the future, many generations, suppose we could solve disease, they wouldn't care if we solved it this year or in 100 years, but they would care everything about whether we kick our carbon habit this year, in 10 years, or in 50 years. It will make a world of difference. So we do have time pressure. The climate is solvable. And if we do it, it really would be, I think, human civilization's greatest achievement.
It could be our finest hour if we beat it. We have been speaking with Dr. Benjamin Strauss, CEO and Chief Scientist for Climate Central, at climatecentral.org. I will put links for the new paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org as well. Ben, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us. We do need to know this.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.